So people do say, oh my God, thank you so much for not making this boring, you know? And I'm not saying these books are boring. They're not. They're just academic in nature, which has a tendency to be drier. But like the one I'm doing now, it's a biology book, basically. But it's so much fun. And the author is just, he writes these personal asides and these things. And it's like, oh yeah, bring it, bring it. I can make you laugh in this book. Let's go. Let's do that.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, speaking with Daniel Henning. Now, Daniel is an audiobook narrator. He's done so much more than that. You're going to learn a lot about his amazing career. But let me tell you how I found Daniel. I was reading / listening to an audiobook called House on the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Klune. Recommend that book. Really, really, really great book. There's now a sequel as well. Just a really, really amazing book. And I am somebody who always, I guess, rents the e-book and the audiobook of a book just to get it done quicker, you know, when I have time to read and in a, you know, at lunch while at work or just different times when it's easier to read instead of an audiobook, I'll do that. And then driving to work, I'll listen to the audiobook so I can get done twice as quick when I can be reading and listening to the same book. But I started the audiobook of House on the Cerulean Sea, and I just loved the way that Daniel read the book that I couldn't read it anymore. And I hope, you know, you see how much of a compliment that is to Daniel, because just the way he read the book, there's several different characters and the voices that he made, it was just amazing. I really, really enjoyed it. I've listened to a lot of audiobooks, and Daniel is at the top of the list when it comes to audiobook narrators. He's won a lot of awards because of that, so I knew I had to have him on, and I learned so much more about him in researching to have him on the show. He owned a playhouse in the past and mentored a lot of big stars that are currently out there now. He actually was honored by the California legislature for his work with LGBTQ plus efforts. He's just he's just such an amazing guy. This is such a cool conversation where it could have just been, you know, or how did you get into reading audiobooks? What is your process of doing that? We certainly do all that. We talk about the nitty gritty of the actual getting in the booth. He's built a booth in his home. But then, you know, we talk so much more about just the world of entertainment, the world of activism. This is one of my favorite conversations, and you know, after 250 of them, I don't say that lightly. So what an honor to speak with Daniel. I really think you're going to enjoy this one. Here is Daniel Henning. So Henning, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great as well. I'm going to let you kind of do the heavy lifting. I've listened to you on other podcasts where they give this big, long, beautiful introduction. I'm not going to do that. Introduce yourself if you would.
Oh my goodness. I don't even know where to start. Hi, I'm Daniel Henning. I'm an audiobook narrator now at this point in my life, and it's what I do all day and all night, basically. Almost every bit of my life is somehow related to books, which is a lovely thing to say. I spent a lot of time in the theater business. I founded a theater in Hollywood, Los Angeles, called the Blank Theater, many, many moons ago. And 2 years ago, I stepped down from there. I'm still on the board, but they're still doing great work. And I'm really proud of what I founded and achieved. But it was time for me to move on. And so I'm an audiobook narrator, amongst many other things that I've done throughout my life.
Absolutely. I love it. We're going to unpack all of the things that you just mentioned, but I want to kind of start at the very beginning, because everything that you've done kind of involves helping others or entertaining others. What created your passion for entertainment?
You know, I was in a play when I was four, and that was it. I was done. Like I just knew I had to do that. And I wasn't doing it you know, like then it was just like fun and I had a great time and, you know, and then I kept doing theater and then I did some, a couple of movies when I was a kid and that was really fun. And, you know, and then I went to NYU and studied acting there and had a great time. And I, you know, and I knew that that was what I was going to do. And I was just always going to be an actor. It never occurred to me to do anything else really. Even though I was interested in politics and other things. And what ended up happening is I came to Los Angeles for pilot season and I founded a theater. That took me on a journey of being a producer and a director. And it took me away from acting actually. But part of what, if you're running a nonprofit theater and you're doing it right, part of what you're creating is for the community. You know, it isn't just putting on good plays or just doing good work. There are, you know, there are these other opportunities that you have is kind of the way I've seen it. So I really started like creating space in at the blank for helping other people. And as it turns out, lots of thousands of actors, but also I've developed over 1,000 new plays. So what was I doing but working with writers, developing their material? And now in my, you know, retirement or whatever you want to call it, I am doing the same thing. I am working with writers and bringing their material to life. So it's like a 180 from what I was doing before, but also not, also like the same thing. You know, and just trying to make a difference in the world through however I can use my voice.
I absolutely love that. And I mean, the blank theater was something I knew nothing about until, you know, I looked at you, you know, researched you more. And I mean, what an amazing thing. I want you to talk just a little bit more about that, because you talk about how you moved from New York. I think that you had a theater company going there as well. And then you moved to Los Angeles, started the blank theater. What's that look like? You know, I feel like a lot of people, when they think of somebody starting a theater, definitely, you know, here us in the Midwest, when we look at a theater, we're thinking, oh, the actual structure of a building. And that's not always what starting a theater means. I mean, sometimes it's just a theater company within another, you know, within another actual structural building of a theater. So I want you to talk a little bit about what it means to actually start a theater and start a theater company.
Well, I mean, the blank theater is by its nature, you know, not confined, right? It's not defined. There's no one thing. So in fact, we didn't have a building and it wasn't meant to do that. Then we did get a building for a long time. But well, for me, so I was running an off-Broadway theater called Circle and Square. There's a Broadway theater called Circle and Square, but originally it was off-Broadway and I ran that theater. And then I came and I'll tell this story. I don't tell this story very often, actually. Maybe this is the first time I've ever told it on a podcast, actually. I was managing the theater, and one night I was, it was the end of an 8-show week on a Sunday night, and I had to deliver the box office paperwork to the doorman at the building where the managing director lived. So, like, after my last show on a Sunday night, I had to, like, you know, deliver this. So I was doing that and I was in New York and I was, you know, walking down the street and I guess I just delivered the paperwork and I was just walking away. And out of nowhere, a guy came up to me and said, "Yo, man, give me your wallet." And didn't give me time to do that. And out of nowhere, brought out a lead pipe and hit me on the head. And knocked me to the ground. And I was with a friend and she told me to run and I did. And she kind of lured the guy away a little bit, but the cops heard me screaming from like a couple blocks away in New York City. I've always had a big voice. they lost the guy, but he ran away. And so I had 47 stitches in my forehead. And because of that, it was a workman's comp case. And so they gave me a cash settlement for my facial scar. It was $4,000. And I was just moving to LA at that time. And I realized, I was like, what do I do with this money? Like, go drinking with my friends? That doesn't seem right. You know, like, I need to do something good with this. Like, I need to change this from bad to good. And so I took that money and I founded the Blank Theater Company. And so that's what that looked like for me, is taking something that was, well, I almost died that night, and I could have easily, but I didn't. And, so I was like, okay, well, I got to take this and I got to use, you know, and if that money, you know, that $4,000, it paid back and paid back and paid back and is still paying back. And, you know, the work that we did at the Blank, and I created the only, nationwide Young Playwrights Festival that professionally produces the work. It's been 32 years that we've been doing this. We've done almost 400 plays by teenage writers from across the nation. One of them won the Tony Award in 2016 for the play The Humans, Stephen Karam. I was just in New York in October, and I saw another one of our winners, his play on Broadway that was called Job. His name is Max Wolf Friedlich. So, you know, that $4,000 has paid dividends for, you know, not only me, but like thousands of artists. So that's what it looked like for me.
I love that. I think there'd be, you know, a lot of people would get that $4,000 and just be like, what a night. I am just going to go splurge and, you know, buy myself a motorcycle or something. So yeah, I think that's really, really amazing. And it's almost probably a weird relationship you have with that experience at this point, just because, you know, I talk to so many people that talk about the weird relationship they have with COVID, that, you know, COVID is what made them so, you know, turn into their next passion and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, maybe all this wouldn't have happened to you if that wouldn't have happened. Of course, nobody wants that to happen, but it certainly opened up a lot of doors, including, I mean, it opened up your door and I guess your forehead for a moment, but
it did. Yes.
Yeah.
And you can't really see the scar anymore because I have lines now, but you could before. It was a very obvious thing before.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, you'd already mentioned some of the people that you've worked with and some of the young people who have went on and done really great things. You know, there's so many more too. I've heard you talk about it in the past. If you would just name a few more people that you've been able to work with, either through that Young Playwrights group or through the Blank Theater. And then also, I guess, kind of what it's like now after so many years to have seen all these people progress into doing amazing things, winning Tony Awards, you know, being blockbuster movie actors. I think that has to be a really powerful thing, given that you're so passionate about helping others.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know. It's a funny thing. I am still able to see talent even in very young people. And so as I look back on my life and the people that were my friends or people I worked with or people that I was like, oh, you just came to town, I think you're really cool, come play with me. You know, like a lot of them have ended up being quite famous. And like I coached Sarah Michelle Gellar on her auditions for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I cast Noah Wiley, who was on ER and he's about to star in this new show called The Pit on Max, in his first play when he was like 19. Molly Shannon was the first person that I met at NYU, and we stayed close and continued to work together for years before she got Saturday Night Live. You know, and it just goes on and on. It's funny, you know, in the audiobook world, people don't really know me in the theater, like from the theater world. So they don't know that background of me. And just today I posted a picture. I did a recording for it. I'm under an NDA, so I can't say what. With Mae Whitman, who is from Parenthood and Arrested Development, and, you know, and we did a play when she was 17 that I directed her in, and she and I got to act together yesterday, which is super fun. And the list is just, I mean, I couldn't even possibly begin to say them all, right? Right. But I have been able to work with a lot of people who then went on to win their Tonys or become Academy Award nominees or, you know, that sort of stuff. But it comes from, you know, they weren't famous then. I didn't know they were going to be famous, except that I knew that they were really talented and kind of, I don't know, my kind of people, you know? So I have, and then it's like, I put up the picture with Mae Whitman today and all kinds of comments are like, oh my God, of course you know her, you know, are kind of the comments that people make. It's like, well, I do know a lot of people. And because of working with the theater in Hollywood for decades and it being a place where people who were in film and television could also come and work with us, we made it really flexible for them. A lot of people did. And they still are, you know, they're still coming. And it's a really lovely thing to see. And it's really, I just feel like a proud papa, you know, watching all of these people sort of make their ascension. And, you know, and if you think I didn't cry when Stephen Karam won that Tony Award, you'd be wrong.
I'm glad that you'd be able to stay connected. And then also this, that so many people have been able to be successful. And you've, I mean, the good thing, because I talk to so many people that have done such amazing things that I just sit and think, man, I wish more people knew about it. And I wish they were, I guess, honored for that. And luckily, at least partially, you have been. I believe that you won an award for your work, both in entertainment and then also your work with the LGBTQ community through the California legislature. What was that like? I watched the video of you walking out onto the floor there. That had to be a really awesome moment.
That was a really awesome moment for a lot of reasons, actually. So one of the things that I do kind of, I'm the resident historian at the Black Cat here in Los Angeles, which is now a gastropub. It's on Sunset Boulevard in Silver Lake, which is where I live, and I've lived for decades. And but in 1966, 67, it was a different place, but called the Black Cat, that same location. And it was the scene of the first major LGBTQ demonstration in the United States. On New Year's Eve, 1966 to 67, two people kissed in this blacked out windowed gay bar. There were, you know, people in drag and, you know, and gay men there. And when they kissed, there were 12 undercover policemen in the bar who tried to start busting heads and arresting people. And the people in that bar said, nope, and they fought back. And so there was a riot. And it went into Sunset Boulevard, and eventually they arrested 16 people. But the queers that night sent three policemen to the hospital as a part of that. And that was 2.5 years before what is known as the Stonewall Rebellion. So 2.5 years before Stonewall, this happened. And when they opened up this gastropub, about 12 years ago now, and they renamed it the Black Cat. And the original sign that was there in 1966, there's a little cat face. It's been there the whole time. Even though other things were there, that little cat face has been there the whole time. And it's still there. I went in there and I loved that they did that they named it this place. So I, for the 50th anniversary, I said, oh, I want to do something big. And they were like, great, let's do it. And I got in touch with the city councilman. And so we did this. So in 2017, 6 weeks after the riot, they then had 500 people came and they did a political rally in 1967 against police harassment and for LGBTQ equality. The organization that put that event together was called Personal Rights in Defense and Education. It was the first time the word pride had ever been used in conjunction with the LGBTQ community. And the newsletter for the Pride that Pride put together to talk about this event and then going forward was called The Advocate. And of course, the national gay news magazine that is still with us is The Advocate. So The Advocate and Pride both came from the Black Cat. So I wanted to recreate that night of the rally in order to create an internet footprint for the story, because no one knew the story of the Black Cat. Everybody knows Stonewall, but no one knew the Black Cat. So I recreated that night from 1967. We had actors come in costumes. We recreated the original signs. There are only four photographs from that night, but we created the signs from that. And then there was an actual political rally that night where people made speeches and it went on for a couple of hours. We did the same thing. Ours was a little different. We weren't fighting the police. We were there in conjunction with the police. We had the mayor of Los Angeles and the associate chief of police and the one organizer still around from that time. And all three of them held their hands and raised it up high. And we had 1,500 people at our event. And now, anytime you see an article about gay rights history in Los Angeles, in the United States, they almost always will mention the Black Cat. And if it's a Los Angeles-based article, they build it around the Black Cat. So I am now the resident historian there. And so a year later, in 2018, the California State Legislature for Pride Month had honored, I think there were 16 of us, I think. And from my work there and then knowing my work at the blank, they honored me. So they brought me up to Sacramento and there was a big ceremony. And one of the other honorees that day is Sarah McBride, who was just nominated as the first trans House of Representatives from Delaware. I'm so proud of her. And I got to be honored with her. So So that's how I was honored by the state. But they also did it, you know, because of my work with young people in the arts as well. So it was a really powerful moment for me. I'm from California. You know, I was the things that I was honored for that day are the things that I was bullied for my whole life when I was growing up. So to be recognized for the thing that I was ostracized for by my home state was incredibly moving and certainly something I will never forget.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I just wonder, why didn't people know about the Black Cat? You just talked about all of the huge things that came out of it. Everyone, I feel like, knows Stonewall. Why didn't people get the memo about, you know, the things happening 2 years prior? I'm always interested just to hear what makes the headlines in the history books and what doesn't until somebody like yourself brings it up.
Well, I would say that I think there are several reasons, not the least of which is New York believes it's the center of the world, and it's gotten lots of other people to believe that as well. So the fact that that was a New York story somehow just, you know, they thought it was more important to everybody. The second thing is Stonewall was three nights, and it went on, and it was a true riot. Rocks, stones, you know, I mean, it was a real riot for 3 days. I believe that if the Black Cat had not happened, that Stonewall wouldn't have happened, at least not in that way. The other thing is that from Stonewall, real changes started to happen, not in laws and things, but just in how people talked about the whole conversation. And people then started to just talk differently about gay rights. But also in 1966, 67, you know, the windows of these bars were blacked out. Like there were two newspaper articles about this thing happening. That's it. And they were in tiny little presses. They were not, none of the major press covered it. You know, in that time, when I look at the picture of these brave people who were there, who let themselves be photographed with these signs, you know, I look at them and I think, well, I mean, they're some of the bravest people I know, except modern day trans people, because they could have been fired from their jobs. They could have been kicked out of their housing. They could have literally had their livelihoods taken from them because they were in that picture, just because they were in that picture. And so I think that's another reason why it didn't catch on the same way Stonewall did, is because it was just a little too early in terms of when people were fed up enough to say, you can't do that anymore. You can't kick somebody out of their housing because you think they're gay, you know, and that started after Stonewall, you know. So it was still a little bit in the, I don't know, the dark ages, if you will, even though it's the 60s, right? You think, what are you talking about? You know, there were, you know, the flower children and all that stuff. Yeah, but not for the gays. Not for the gays yet, anyway.
Yeah. Well, that is certainly a topic I think that we could probably spend another hour talking about, but we're gonna pivot into now your audiobook narration, because that's how I found you. And I just wonder, you know, we've talked so much about all the amazing things that you've done. So now we've got to figure out, how did you decide to start, I guess, narrating audiobooks? It's an interesting pathway. I've talked to a lot of people in voiceover, but no one that's ever done narration in book form before.
You know, when I was looking to transition out of the blank theater, I was trying to figure out a way to make money, because I didn't, it's a tiny theater, so I never really made any money, a little stipend, but not really. And so I needed to at least cover that. But I didn't want to, like, I don't know, start making auto parts or something. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted to, you know, not against anybody who does that. That's an amazing thing. But I don't have that skill. So it's like, how do I use my skills and make money, but on a consistent basis? And I had been working with a playwright that I directed his plays. His name was Jeff Tabnick. The play was called Something Truly Monstrous. And it's about the well-substantiated rumor that on the night that John Barrymore died, Peter Lorre and Humphrey Bogart stole his body and went joyriding. So that's what this play was about. And I loved it. And we, you know, and a year later, I was starting to think about that. And I asked him, well, you have something to do with audiobooks, right? You direct them or something? I'd love to get some advice. And he said, I'm the casting director for the largest audiobook company in the world. I was like, oh, okay, well, what do you think? He said, I think you'd be great at it, actually. And so he gave me my first opportunity and he gave me my first 10 opportunities and he really shepherded me into the business. And that was how it began for me. But as I look back on it, like books have always been a big part of my life. And when I first came to Hollywood, I was a reader, you know, like in Hollywood, like you, people are hired to read a script and give what they call coverage, which is a synopsis and then your opinion. And except that I wasn't doing, of course, I've never done anything like everybody else does. So for whatever reason, I wasn't reading scripts. I was doing coverage, but they were books. So, you know, like now I look back on it all, I'm like, oh, well, I've been working with books my whole life, like, but I didn't realize it. So it seems like a natural fit. And then when I'm actually doing what I do, the director part of me, the producer part of me, the writer, the person who's developed over 1,000 new plays, and the actor, they're all in the booth with me. And so it makes, it's, even though it's a really hard thing to do, it's exhausting and lonely. And, you know, I recorded 3 hours of a book today and about 5.5 hours alone in, you know, alone in this little box here, you know. It's hard. It's really hard, but I find it sort of easy. You know, it's pretty easy for me. I just seem to have a natural affinity for it. And I get to do a lot of different kinds of, a lot of different genres. And that's really kind of fun too. And it also helps me stay, just stay alive, you know, because like right now I'm doing a book about literally the evolution of sexuality, but like not in humans, like in like invertebrates. And, you know, like, so it's a massive academic book, but it's also fun and I'm having a great time. And then, you know, and then I just did this multicast with May yesterday. And then I have, you know, like, so, and then the next thing I'm doing is, I don't know, something else entirely. And then the fiction thing, and then a book on crypto. And then, you know, so I'm always doing different stuff, and that I use all of those different skills in all of those different books, but it helps me, you know, really stay present to it.
Yeah. And you just opened the door of your little black box. I love that you've got your name on it. I don't know whether you ever just get so entranced that you forget where you're supposed to go, but you know where you're going based on the name right there.
Well, this is, it's silly, but this is a really nice, like, this is like a really plastic, this is a really great nameplate that they made for me for a trailer. When I was on an episode of Beverly Hills 90210 that took place on Jeopardy. So it was, so this was the nameplate, but it's not like a cardboard thing. This is like a really nice thing. So I took it because it's nice, you know? So I've had this around forever. And it was like, and then finally I was like, oh, I should put this on my booth door just in case anyone wonders whose booth this is in my house.
I like that. And you know, what you were saying earlier about how, you know, you've kind of been a part of books and narrating your entire career and didn't even know it. I mean, as somebody who has now interviewed, I don't know, 300 plus people, I'm always kind of a sucker for voice just because, you know, that's what I deal with so much. And I mean, I do think you have the perfect voice when it comes to narration. I watched a video of you before the beard, you know, I think it was 12, 15 years ago. And you, even in that interview, before you even narrating, I just think you have the perfect voice for things. So I guess that was no question there, just to give you a little bit of a big head if I can.
Well, it's funny, you know, cause like I taught acting for a long time. And one of the things I did was, a relaxation exercise before the first half hour of class was that. And then I would give these speeches at the Blank and the Young Playwrights Festival. And so many people always talked about, like with the relaxation exercises, like how much my voice relaxed them. Like they would record it and they would listen to it every night before they'd fall asleep. And, you know, and then the speeches that I would give at the Blank, people were always really, they really responded to them and they always said things to me about that, you know? So it's like the clues were all there, but I just didn't see them, You know, I never thought about doing any of this when I was actually working at the blank. I never thought about being a voice actor or anything. I didn't know I had this ability to do all these characters like I do. I didn't know. You know, I was focused somewhere else. And, you know, so it's over the years, people weren't saying you should be narrating audiobooks, but people were telling me that my voice has an effect on them, you know? And now I get emails and notes and things from people. People go to my website and leave me a note and, you know, and say things like, The House in the Cerulean Sea is my comfort listen. Whenever I'm sad or lonely or bored, I'll just put on a chapter of it because it makes me happy. Or other people I've met tell me that they literally listen to it every night to fall asleep. And I say, I'm going to take that as a compliment because you just told me that when I do my work, you fall asleep. but it's, you know, but it really is a compliment, right? To be able to be that intimate in my work and allow people to feel that connection to me. And I just had a note today. Literally, somebody just wrote me and said, I love you, you know, because I'm in their ear, you know, and whatever the quality I have that makes people, you know, interested, people like really, really take that in. Not everybody, believe me, some of the reviews on Audible are evil, but it's okay. I don't want it to be for everybody.
No. And like when I wrote you, generally when I pick up a book, I get the ebook form and then I get the audiobook form. That way I can power through things quickly. When I can read, I'll read. And when I'm in the car, I'll listen and get things done quickly. But yeah, when I picked up The House on the Cerulean Sea, once I started listening, I was like, I feel like I'm missing something if I try to read it myself. So I wasn't able to do that, which I think should be a compliment to you for sure. So I love those books, and I love the way that you read them too. But I want to kind of get to, I guess, your process in it all. What's the preparation for beginning to read an audiobook? Is it something where you need to read the entire book first just to kind of get the feel of it and how you're going to create, you know, the voices, make sure that it's something that you even want to read? Do people give you kind of a one pager so you're not stuck reading a thousand books before you even, I guess, get paid to do it? Or what's that look like?
Well, first of all, just to make a reference, T.J. Clune, who wrote The House in the Cerulean Sea and Somewhere Beyond the Sea, he says, and I'm just quoting him, but he says that, honestly, the way to experience these two Cerulean books is to listen to Daniel's audiobook. He tells people to listen to the audiobook as opposed to reading the book that he wrote. So, you know, and I can't tell you like what an incredible like compliment that is, because his writing is just breathtaking, and I hear it and I see it and it's so vivid to me. And this will lead to the thing the fact that he thinks that about what we do together is just mind blowing to me. So your experience with the audiobook is, you know, what he would want in a way. Yeah.
Absolutely. And before I answer the other question in a minute, but I'll forget this part. I guess now thinking about it, because I know that the House in the Cerulean Sea, that was supposed to be a standalone and it wasn't supposed, yeah, there wasn't supposed to be another one. Obviously it did so well that, you know, it made sense to make another, but I just wonder, it would probably be a question for him, but I just wonder, given that first book had came out, he had kind of heard what you had done with it. I wonder how that went into him creating the next book. I feel like he had to have your voice in his head thinking, how's Daniel going to read this? And I feel like it probably made it easier for him to write the book.
Well, I can answer part of that question, which is yes. He says in public all the time that he's written like 30 books. There's only one character of his that he cannot. And usually he's done with the book and the characters go to sleep. They're gone. They don't come back. There's only one character of his that he has not left his head, will not leave his head. And it's Chauncey. And Chauncey.
Oh, I love it. He's got the stuff down.
I do, because it's, you know, I'm a plushie, for God's sake. You bet I have one. And available at Barnes & Noble in Kingdom of Threads. But he says that Chauncey has not left his head, and when he hears Chauncey's voice in his head, he hears my Chauncey. So he says that I live in his head. So, yes, definitely I was in his head when he was writing book two. And that was good and fun for him, but also because he's evil, he did really hard things. He wrote some really hard things for me to do, to see, like, oh, good, let's see how Daniel does this. So, and he's also said publicly, there is a book three coming.
Oh, good.
It's going to be a couple years, but there's a book three coming. So
I love it. And I'm going to ask you another question before I let you finally answer the other one, because you just mentioned Chauncey. So I've only listened to half of that one book, and then a little bit of other books, just to kind of hear you reading other things, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But, you know, I've in the female characters, I can kind of hear in the male characters, maybe a little bit of Linus, but nobody, I don't know that you're breaking out Chauncey for any other book. I feel like that may be just for these books.
Well, you know, I mean, I only have the one throat.
Yeah.
Right. So there's the beloved character in TJ's In the Lives of Puppets. There are these two robots. Well, there's a lot of robots in it, but there are two robots in it, and they are Rambo and Nurse Ratched. And Rambo is definitely Chauncey's cousin, but not because I don't have the imagination or whatever, but because they have similar qualities. They are written by the same man, you know? So, and then my throat is doing them. So some people might say that Chauncey and Rambo are a little bit related here and there. I worked really hard in Somewhere on the Sea to bring an entirely different voice for David, the new character, the Yeti. Because all these other characters were established, everybody loves them so much. And David's voice, of course, TJ described it like cracked ice. Thanks, TJ. I'll get working on that. Thank you. And I don't think of any of it in that realm. And I guess this will take me now to the answer to your question, right? So if it's nonfiction, you have to do the research to get the pronunciations correct. So there's a lot of work that goes into a nonfiction book. But a fiction book, I absolutely read it from word one to the last word. Somewhere Beyond the Sea, I think I read 3 or 4 times. Normally I just don't have the time to do that much work. But that book was so important and so special that I did. But I certainly read all fiction at least once, if not more than once. As I read through the book, I don't take a lot of notes. We don't have a lot of time. So it has to be like, my work is just gut instinct. Like, any choice you hear me make in any of these books, it's not because I decided that line was going to sound that way. Or even that, like, you know, that there's some passages in Somewhere Beyond the Sea where the narration gets quite, I don't even know the word for it. It gets huge, but that's what's happening in the story. And so I didn't decide I was going to narrate it. I was going to let it grow like that as this character literally was growing. But there it is. The words are on the page. It's growing. And because of my work with writers over the years, I can see writing. I can see pacing. It's just really obvious to me. So I lean into all of that stuff. So I don't mark any of that stuff, but I do mark when the characters make their first entrance in the book. And that's the same for like a major character as it is for somebody who has one line, because actually when they first appear, I don't know whether they're going to be one line or a major character. But that's also when a character usually gets described. So the author is usually talking about that character right then. But I just highlight it and I keep going. And then I will go back and start at the page one and go to the highlights and find each of the characters, read everything I can about them, take as much time in that moment to flip through or look at other lines, whatever. And then I'll create what I call a voice print. So I'll create the voice. And then I'll make a recording of it. But even that isn't technical. Like, I don't think, oh, this one's going to be nasally, or this one's going to be high, or this one's going to be low. I mean, there are some aspects of that because I want if there's two male characters, I want you to be able to tell the difference between the two. So I'm probably going to have one who speaks a little higher and one who speaks a little lower because it's just easier for you to hear that. But what I'm really doing is living inside the characters. So even if I have this voice printer, I have this voice character that I've created, that's just the jumping off point, because then that character goes on the journey that that character goes on, and that changes how they talk in a moment, in any moment. If, you know, they might not talk like, they might not sound like that initial recording in this scene because they're mountain climbing in the Himalayas and they're whatever, who knows, you know what I mean? But so those are also just, you know, like Chauncey's voice grows, it changes, you know? And in Somewhere Beyond the Sea, it was really fun for all of those voices because they grew up a little bit from the first book, but they grew up a lot during the book. So like Sal, I was really happy to be able to, he starts as a shy voice. And in the first book, he was very shy almost the whole time. But in the second book, he finds his voice. So I was able to find Sal's voice, even though the one I'd originally created was this shy voice, you know. So I really do think that they're alive in me. And they just, once I have the sort of idea of who they are, I let them go where they go. And so they really do take on a life of their own, if you will, you know, and I'm always thrilled to, you know, let them run, you know? And so it's a remarkable journey for me to go on, because I feel like I'm channeling somehow. It's not just me. It's me and every teacher I've ever had and every actor I've ever worked with. But more importantly, it's like my soul is just responding to these words, and these words make that line come out this way.
So have you talked to a lot of other, I guess, audio narrators, just because I feel like in most books that I listen to, you know, that they have one or two male voices, one or two female voices, and they just get switched back and forth. They don't put that much into it. You just talked about how, you know, these characters live in you, and that, I mean, obviously it shines through, and that's why I think you've had the success that you've had. But have you talked to a lot of other people, and do they share this passion? Just because I guess I'm kind of just, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of in awe of just how much thought you put into all of it, and just in listening to you right now talk about it.
Well, I would say that in general, audiobook narrators are really hard workers. And oh, yeah. So I would think that most of them would think that they're a significant portion, more than half maybe, would want to live in the realm that I'm talking about. You know, this place where the characters are, you know, are real characters, and they're trying to really tell each of their stories. And, you know, I would say old school narration is more flat, you know, is more just reading the words and not putting a lot on top of that. But that's an art in and of itself, to be able to, you know, with tiny, subtle little variations. I've never been subtle about anything in my life. So, I mean, and I can do that. I just did a what they call literary fiction, which is they wanted a lot like, and then I was walking down the street and I, you know, that, you know, that sort of thing. I can do that. And I was really proud of the one I did this year. But it's not where I really live. But most narrators really want to get this right. And we're not paid enough money to do that. We're pretty crazy people. Most people are super dedicated, and they will read it several times, and they may not live at sort of the height where I do in a lot of my narration. But that doesn't mean that they're not living at their own height, if that makes sense. So I would say that, yeah, a lot of narrators want to be differentiating characters. They may not have the ability to do more than two male voices and two female voices. That might be it. But, you know, like, they work really hard to get the accents right. You know, I mean, like a lot of most audiobook narrators I know, if they got a book that required an Irish accent, they would go to a coach, and they would get coached on the Irish accent because they don't want it to sound Scottish or Welsh or something. You know what I mean? So I would say that in general, yeah. I'm definitely like, I've just studied so much in my life and been a part of so many creations of dramatic situations inside the theater I do the work and I'm super prepared, super, 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 super prepared, but I also let it fly. So sometimes my accents go a little wonky. I don't care because I'm so invested in the moment. You probably won't even notice it.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I'll say about, I guess, my experience in reading or in listening to the books that you've been a part of is, you know, I've listened to hundreds of books and I feel like it's not, audio narration is almost a thing that you don't necessarily realize when people are doing a passable job. You realize when they're doing a really bad job or a really, really good job. And I don't really feel like I honestly, until I've listened to the books that you've narrated, I've never really even looked at the name of the narrator. So I do think that says something for sure. So
thank you very much. Big compliment. Thank you.
For sure. So I want to ask you, just because you talked a little bit about how you prepare for things and that you don't necessarily, you know, put a lot of notes into it. You may read it three or four times, but you don't put a ton of notes. And I feel like that just makes it, I guess, even more interesting on how you're able to successfully create these voices, just because, you know, I was listening today to, there's always, every time that I talk to somebody, I'm always going to forget something. I cannot remember the name of that other book. What's the name of the other book?
The Body in the Back Garden.
The Body in the Back Garden. I was listening to that today and listening to it, you know, with knowing that I'm speaking to you today in mind and thinking about how you were able to narrate it. And for instance, you know, the officer character, when he came to that investigation, you had to create a voice for him. And it was, I think, like two or three chapters later that he was actually described and that we actually heard kind of what he was about, maybe a little bit about his physical characteristics. So that, and you kind of answered it, but I just wonder how you create these characters, because a lot of times you're right, you know, exactly what you said, they are described immediately when they're introduced, but sometimes that's not the case. So how did you already, what kind of notes did you have to take to be able to know that this is going to be kind of a deep voice, rougher, kind of masculine type guy, but we don't learn for two chapters that's who he is?
Well, that book is a mystery, right? So it's a cozy mystery, as they say, but it's also a cozy queer mystery. So there's going to be some romance element in it, right? And so, if I'm narrating something in general, you know, I'm not going to narrate a book like this because that's not my natural state of being. But if that's what the book required, I would. I just don't get those books a lot, right? So... the narrator often lives in my natural ranges so that I can really let myself go, you know? And so oftentimes the romantic character who's opposite the main character will, I want him to sound different. So, you know, so sometimes, you know, I will purposely, I will make a choice that is different than that. With that one, I did. I found, you know, I got to that place in the book and I had already read that. So I already knew who he was. But then it's just like, who is he? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not just like, oh, he's the guy and he's a cop and he's a this or whatever, but he's also, he has a partial indigenous background and whatever, but also just like, okay, well, when these two people are talking to each other, like, how are they relating, you know? And that's a lot of where I find that, too, is in literally how the characters talk to each other. Funny little note about accents, by the way, on that book, because that book is written by a Canadian, and it takes place in Canada. But I'm not going to do, you know, I'm not going to, you know, do an aboot, you know, Canadian accent, because it's so cheesy, right? when an American does that, because they're so, it's so subtle, right? So it's so subtle that in that book, I didn't need to, he's not French. I didn't need to, you know, whatever. But I was like, okay, but the author's Canadian and it takes place in Canada. And I'm assuming that Canadians are going to listen to this. So I want to give them something. Just a, like, what's one word that I can say and not a boot, right? That is like, you know, I can keep, and I was like, I know what it's going to be. And it shows up a lot in that book. And now when you hear it, you'll laugh when I do it. But in that book, I'm totally my accent, never do anything else, except when I say, sorry.
Is that right?
I always say sorry in the Canadian way in that book. So that's my little bit of an accent for that book.
I love that. I love it. And it, the last question I have when it comes to just the process of narrating, what does it look like when it comes to booking these jobs? Do you create, you know, like a one chapter and, you know, the author is listening to a bunch of them? Is it even the author that makes the decision? Is it the publisher? Like what's that look like?
Well, I'll answer that in two parts. I'll tell you about how I got the House of the Cerulean Sea, and then I'll answer it in a bigger way. So I had been narrating a little bit through that guy who hired me for that while I was still running the blank. And there's a way to meet, there are no casting agents per se, and there's no agent submissions. There's no way to like, mostly, there's no way to know what books are available. So the people who are the producers are also the casting people. There are a few companies that have casting directors separate, but in general, they're one and the same. So you just have to know them. Like that's the only way. You just have to meet them somehow, some way. So one of the ways you can do that is there's a one-day conference every other year now called APAC. And it's where everybody is for one day. And so in 2019, I sent out 30 emails to people who I had their email addresses and somebody had said, you got to know these people. And I said, I'm going to be at APAC. I'd love to meet you. And I put some samples, some links to samples. I got an email back like 15 minutes later from a man named Tom Meese, who was at Macmillan. And he said, I just listened to your samples. I love your voice. I can't wait to meet you. Great. Because it's hard. It's hard to get to meet these people and to get in, right? And so I went to this conference and knowing he was there and I found him and I walked up and I said, I'm Daniel Henning. He's like, oh, it's so great to meet you. He's like, I have a book for you in winter 2020. And this was like May of 2019. And I was like, oh, great. Well, you have my email. You know how to get me. And then I get this audition and it was The House in the Cerulean Sea. But it was just the first chapter. So I didn't see any more of the book. The first chapter of that book is actually Linus, the main character, is in it, but no one else is. It's a whole different scene. Everything about it is different. But I didn't know that. This was the book. So I worked on it and I worked hard on it and I did my audition and I got the book. And so what I didn't know was that Tom Meese was so sure that this was my book. And T.J. Klune had done, like I say, like 30 books at that point, but he indie self-produced the audiobooks and things. So he didn't even know if at Macmillan he could say who did the audiobook. He didn't even know. And before he could ask the question, Tom Meese said, here's the one audition that you need to listen to for this book. This is the guy. And T.J. heard it and he immediately knew, oh my God, this is the guy. So I got the job. I didn't know that I was the only one up for it. And that's a almost never happens kind of scenario, which I'll explain in a minute. But so then I sat down to do the book. It's just like 2 months earlier, I got the job or whatever. I sat down to do the book and I kept listening to that chapter because I wanted to get whatever tone it was that they wanted. Like I wanted to get that back and make sure I got that. And I was listening to it. And I was like, I've never done this before or since, actually. But I said, oh, and he asked me to do the whole chapter. Normally, an audition is 5 minutes. But he gave me the whole chapter because he didn't know me and he just wanted to sort of see. I was like, sure, fine, no problem. So when I started to sit down to record it, I was like, I don't know what I would do differently. I don't know what I would change. So I reached out to Tom and I said, is this a strange thing? And no, this is so weird, but can we use my audition as the first chapter? And he wrote back and he said, well, you nailed it. So yeah, I think we should. So the first chapter of The House in the Cerulean Sea was my audition for The House in the Cerulean Sea.
I love it. That's awesome.
So, but normally how things happen is you either get an email that says, here's, we have a book for you. Can you do it? Do you want to do it? It's like, it's a direct offer. Sometimes you get an email that says, here's a book. It's in this time frame. Are you interested? We will be, you know, we'll be submitting a few people. Are you interested? And I can say yes or no. And then they submit me and then they pick somebody. And sometimes there are auditions. With rare exception, if I'm auditioning or if I'm one of those people that they asked if I want to do the book, if I'm available, there are two to four other people that are auditioning or being submitted. And that's it. Three to five people are up for every book. So the people who do what they do work really hard to pick those three to five people. And then usually those auditions are passed on to the author. Sometimes it's the author's agent or in conjunction with, or depends on who the author is. Sometimes it's an estate, the author's dead, and, you know, things like that. But so sometimes they just give me a book. Sometimes they ask me if I'm interested and then throw me in a pile with other names. And sometimes they actually have me audition. But it's still a very small pool. I mean, I've spent my life in Hollywood, right? You know, hundreds of people auditioning, 500 people auditioning for the, you know, call for you on line one, Mr. Jones role, you know. But the numbers in the audiobook world, if you get to the places where the good stuff is, like you've got a good shot at getting everything you're up for, you know, got at least a 20% shot, you know. And I really like that about this business. I don't feel like I'm wasting my time as much in auditioning. You know, if I don't get a book, I just don't get a book. It's fine. There's going to be another one, you know. But with like TV or film or something like that, it's not. It's a really tough numbers game, you know.
Yeah. You feel pretty good about being offered an audition for that third Cerulean Sea book?
I don't think there will be any auditions for that. Yeah. I think the fans would go insane if I didn't narrate it.
I agree with you there. So what's it look like when we've got you through the auditions or just being, you know, accepting the book? What does it look like? Are you doing one book at a time? Is it something where you kind of got to break your mind away, or do you need to focus on one at a time? What are you doing? Several? Or are you doing one at a time?
Different people do it different ways. I'm very much, I am working on several projects at once because I might be prepping a book, which is reading the fiction and like I explained that, or nonfiction. I'm going through and pulling out the terms and getting, my husband actually does my research for me. So that's really great. But like, you know, so I might be prepping that and recording something different during the day. In general, I prefer to start a book and finish it and then start the next one and finish it. But like this book I'm in the middle of, I had to step away yesterday and do this other multicast project with Mae Whitman. So sometimes other things pop up, but I'm in charge of my schedule. It's very rare that, I mean, sometimes there's a last minute, oh my God. We were starting to record this with an author and he was just dreadful. And we finally said, please let us hire a professional narrator to do this. And the author finally said, yeah, I am pretty dreadful. Okay. Except we need this done in 2 weeks. So can you, you know, and I'll try to do those if I can, if it's something I want to do, because, you know, work is work, right? So, but in general, I like to do one book at a time and finish it and then do the next book and finish it and do the next book and finish it. But I am prepping. You know, like my iPad or one of my iPads I read off a big iPad in the booth, but I have the smaller iPad that is like stapled to my hand because I'm either, you know, dealing with the, you know, emails and things that are coming in because we're entrepreneurs. So we're, it's all just us. But I'm also in my, like, I annotate, I have five books that are all in prep phase that are there that I've either read or haven't yet or whatever, but they're all there so that I can just open up I annotate and go, oh, okay, what am I prepping today? You know, but the actual, but then, you know, and then the, but the narration is one and done and done and done, you know. But sometimes things are booked long time in advance. And I mean, the third Cerulean book I'm going to do, I don't know, 3 or 4 years from now, maybe. So it's sort of booked, but you know, who knows when. But other, so other things I'm booked 6 months in advance, and some things like it's a last minute thing. So it's all a little shifty and changey. But I like that. I'm able to, you know, having run a theater for so long, I can deal with changes. Not a problem. But I also get to, like, you know, I have my life the way I like it. Like, I'm not going away for Christmas when everyone else goes away. I'm going away in January because it's cheaper and I have something particular I'm going to do. And it's not when all the tourists will be there. And I can just, I'm going to work every day right around Christmas and New Year's, all of that. And then I'm just going to take my time off and go on my trip. You know, so I get to schedule all of it. But it doesn't mean, in general, like that trip in January, it doesn't mean I'm not going to do whatever book I was offered. It just means I'll just put it in February or whatever, you know. Oh. So it gives me lots of flexibility while also, you know, keeping me inside this dark box all day long.
Yeah. And it sounds like you just mentioned that your husband helps you with the research side. So at least you take input at least in that. What's it like when it comes to the actual narration? Are you somebody who likes to just trust your own instinct and go with that? Do you bounce ideas off of him or other people, you know, trying to get a character right? Or what's that look like?
In general, there when you work for Penguin Random House, you generally will have a director with you, but they're not like a theater director. They're there to make sure you're saying the words right. They might say, oh, you know what? You might take this paragraph again. You know, they might give a couple of little things here and there or help a little bit with the shape of something maybe. But in general, it's pretty much you do you. And it took me, I've done like, I think this is my... I think I'm working on my 267th book. But the first like 100 of them, and I'm not really exaggerating, I was always sort of going, oh God, what do they want? You know, what, oh God, what are they, you know, like, oh my God, I hope they'll hire me again. I hope, you know, I hope I don't ruin it. And there's almost no feedback in this business. It's just so, there's so much, you know, books are super long and they do lots of them. And, you know, so there's not a lot of like, you did great on that last book. It doesn't, they just give you another book and that's how you find out. But so I was, for a long time, I was like, what do they want? And I try to like do what they want, right? But I realized what they want is me. They hired me to do that book. So what they want is for me to do my best job at doing that book. And I would say out of 267 books, there are like two, and I won't tell you what they are, that like I maybe shouldn't have done, or I maybe didn't do what they wanted because really I didn't really mesh with the material. You know, I was trying to deliver what I thought the book was asking for, which is a much better question to ask. Not what do the producers want or the publishers want, but what does the author want? What is the author saying in these words? And so what I deliver is what I can see that the author says in those words. So now I've figured out that that's what they want me to do. They want me to take my instrument and play that symphony that was written by T.J. Klune. So I do that. And sometimes am I too big sometimes? I don't know. I'm just doing what I'm doing. And, you know, so there are some people who don't like my work, but I'm sure there's some people who don't like everybody's work because nobody likes everything. I'm not a taco. I can't make everybody happy. So I sometimes actually go on Audible, and especially with Cerulean Sea or Somewhere Beyond the Sea, but and you know, read, and I read like I'll read reviews, but I don't read all of it, but I read some, right? And actually, the ones that I'm fascinated by are the ones that say, like, this is the best audiobook I've ever heard in my life. And then the next one is like one star and says, worst narration ever. And I love that. Not that, I mean, I do want to make everybody happy, but, you know, but I can't, and I know that. But like, I certainly made them feel something one way or another. So, you know, so I feel like that's also a win, you know? If the reviews were like, meh, that I'd be upset, you know?
Yeah, I get that. I get that for sure. I want, you know, we've talked so much about the fun books that you've been able to do, which is numerous, but you know, you also have to pay the bills, and not every book is going to be amazing when it comes to like the fun aspect. So, you know, yeah. I've done a deep dive into some of your other work, and I've listened to 5 or 6 minutes of you, you know, talking about mathematical equations and formulas. So how do you get yourself excited for some books that I'm not going to say are not, you know, are boring, but maybe just not, you know, not joyful reading anyways.
Yeah, people are academic and textbooks. And I do, TJ Klune, anytime TJ and I do a public event, he always makes me talk about the 3 or 4 like 20-hour study guides for the exam to become a computer cloud security professional. It tickles him pink that Chauncey reads those books. the way I do it, honestly, I'm next month, I'm doing a 27-hour book on Bitcoin and crypto. That is not going to be fun, but I just pretend it is. I just make it fun for myself. You know, I like learning things. I like teaching things. You know, so I like those study guides. How I made those fun for myself was when the quizzes came up, and like when I was listing the answer or the questions, and then answer is B. Like I just had fun, like give it that, right? Because I do think in those books, even more so, if I can bring them alive for the listener who has to listen to the 27-hour book on whatever, like on what could be a dry subject, I think that's like a specialty I have, you know? So even in the driest thing, like if I can just give you a little bit more life than you expect in it, then it's going to make it, you're going to enjoy the book more. And at the end of the day, that's my job. My job is to deliver the book to you in a way, in the best way for you to take it in, whatever that is, you know, and it's in my opinion of what that is, right? But, and for the Cerulean books, it's living deeply in the characters and bringing them fully to life. In another book, it's finding the humor wherever I can, or just keeping it alive, not droning on, you know, so...
Do you ever get to read Audible reviews on some of those type of books?
It's funny, they get reviewed a little less in that way, but yes, like those books about the computer cloud security professional, like one of them had like 5 stars for like quite a long time. So people do say, "Oh my God, thank you so much for not making this boring." You know, and I'm not saying these books are boring; they're not. They're just academic in nature, which has a tendency to be drier. But like the one I'm doing now, it's a biology book basically, but it's so much fun. And the author is he writes these personal asides and these things, and it's like, oh yeah, bring it. I can make you laugh in this book. Let's go. Let's do that.
I love that. And you know, this is a question I ask authors a lot, maybe a little bit more difficult for you to answer just because, you know, it's not the audio is your work, but you're reading somebody else's. So people, you know, when people happen to kind of dish on their own work, it's a little easier. But I always like to ask people, you know, okay, of course we've talked about your New York Times bestseller and the book that everyone raves about, but what's a book that you have that hasn't gotten as much, as much credit and as much play, but it should, that you're really, really proud of it. So what's something that you've recorded that maybe very few people know about? You've got two Audible reviews of it, but it's just a really awesome thing and you wish more people listen.
There's two things, and one I'll just mention, and then there's two that come to mind, like two of my, in the past couple of years, my most favorites. And I'm actually, the Society of Voice Arts Awards are coming up in like a week and a half, and it's like the SAG Awards. It's like, it's the peer judged awards for the voice community. And, I am almost embarrassed to say that I'm nominated in 8 categories.
Of course you are. Of course.
And two of these books are in of these nominations. The first one actually is Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence that I did this year. And there are many versions of that as audiobooks. So that hasn't really had a lot of listens because it just came out and whatever. But I am so freaking proud of my work in that. I can't even tell you. I'm deeply proud of that. The other one is a book I did last year, which is nominated in the humor category. And it's called Farrell Covington and the Limits of Style. And it's by Paul Rudnick, who is a Broadway playwright. He wrote the movies Sister Act and Adam's Family Values. And he's a writer for The New Yorker. And he's funny as all get out. And this book is a 50-year story that takes place in like real, you know, like real American history and the real history of the gay movement. Paul gave the main character basically his writing career. So this writer doesn't write a movie called Sister Act. He writes a movie called Habit Forming. So it really is like a Ramona Clay. It really is like a lot of things from his real life. And so the characters in it are actually real life people, but they're, you know, covered. And then he adds this character named Farrell Covington, and these two main characters have a 50-year love relationship that goes through it. And it is epic and beautiful and funny and brilliant, and I'm really good in it. And I'm really deeply proud of what I was able to give to Paul's book. So that's certainly one of the ones that I am just, and I can pretty much guess that I always will be deeply proud of that book, and it will always be like one of my top 10.
Something to check out for sure. So do you feel, you know, you've done so much, this is kind of where your passion lies right now. Do you feel like if this is what you do, that I guess the rest of your career, are you content in your current work?
I am. You know, as people say, like, well, what do you want to do in your retirement? Well, I'd like to, I don't know, sit around and read books. Okay, well, yeah. Guess what I get to do, right? And I get health insurance out of it, so that's great, right? I do, again, I didn't realize I had sort of these abilities, so I never thought about it before. But I do, I now understand that I do have a large capacity for characters, for creating characters and sort of big, wild characters and stuff. So I am getting into animation. I'd like to do that as well, because I think I'd just have a great time. And I obviously have if you've listened to Cerulean, you know I can do that, right? So I really enjoy doing the character work. So that's a place where I'm able to do that. So that's something else I'd like to explore more as well. But in general, yeah, I feel like I think maybe if I was just doing like romances all day long, which often are quite similar when you have a bunch of them, you know, or just thrillers or, you know, like just one genre, I think I might get a little more bored. I know that people do, but because I'm bouncing around from, you know, Ukrainian short stories to House in the Cerulean Sea to, you know, even the textbooks, whatever. Like it's never the same thing twice in a row, pretty much. And I even have a little bit of a chance to schedule it that way too, right? So I can make sure I don't have two crypto textbooks back to back or something. Or I can say no. At least for now, I feel super content. I don't have to leave my house. I can be with my dog and, you know, and not wear shoes or pants or, you know, and yeah. Just, you know, and just go read a good book, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm getting more well-known, I'm getting better books, right? So the books are getting better, which is really interesting. People have been really great with me, and they've always, like, almost all of the books I've done, I've found something to really be interested in. And so I'm honored that the producers and the casting people and the publishers hear me in all of these different ways, you know, because it keeps it alive for me for sure.
Yeah, I can't imagine just all the things that you've been able to learn just through reading all these books. That has to be really cool too.
Yeah, it is. I speak a little Russian. I was a guest of the Soviet Union at the end of the Soviet Union to visit Soviet theaters and theater schools when I was a kid, basically. And so I learned a little Russian before I went, and I never used it again, but I was glad I did. But then audiobooks come along, and if you have a little bit of a language in audiobooks, that's a good thing. So they'll hire you to do books that have like a lot of Russian names or whatever. So I've done something like 300 hours in total, like many books of Russian, Soviet, Ukrainian, Belarusian history. And certainly Ukraine now, with there's so many things. I mean, I've done, you know, some like modern history, some, you know, like Kutuzov, the general who won against Napoleon, you know, to I just did a finished a book about called Battleground Ukraine. So I had this little skill, which is, you know, я говорю плохо по-русски, which means I speak terrible Russian. And but because of that, I can pronounce things properly. So I've been given a lot of Russian stuff. Well, I mean, the world right now, it's important to be aware of what's happening there. So I am, you know, and I feel like I have a master's degree in, you know, in Russian, Ukrainian, Soviet history at this point because of the hours and hours and hours and hours and hours that I've done. So yeah, and I really, you know, I appreciate that. I know more about the world than I knew before. And I, you know, I knew a lot about the world, but like even more now. And I kind of also love a little bit of the random nature of it. Okay, you're gonna learn about, you know, today you're gonna learn about Kutuzov. That's, you know, and then tomorrow it's gonna be about whatever. You're gonna do an Edith Wharton novel, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really cool, and I love that you know, the listener, at least my listeners, have been able to learn a little bit more about you today. We there's so much more we could cover. You know, we didn't even talk about your I guess close personal relationship with Star Wars, your small your small role in the band Played On. You've done so many really, really cool things. I guess how can people connect with you? I guess, you know, there's so many books they can just pick up and listen to your voice, but how are they going to connect with Daniel Henning?
Well, my website is danielhenning.net. I'm on all the socials at Daniel Henning LA. You can go to Audible or even Libby and type in Daniel Henning and narrator search, and you'll find a lot of those things. I will say, if you're interested, Google Daniel Henning, Alec Guinness, Star Wars, and you'll find that story, which, as you say, is we could probably do a whole podcast just on that, because I am literally, this is such a crazy thing to say out loud, but I'm literally a world famous Star Wars fan.
Yeah. you certainly are.
When I meet people and that story happens to come up, they'll say, oh my God, you were that kid? Everywhere I tell that story, there's someone in there who goes, you're that kid? So, yeah. But we'll leave that for your listeners to find for themselves.
Absolutely. Well, I really
did a little audiobook of that story, actually. So if you poke around my Audible or you know, you may find that there too. So,
yeah. Well, that's what I recommend people do. Yeah. No, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Jackson. Thank you.
So that was Daniel Henning. Just an honor and a thrill to speak with him. So glad that he was able to dedicate a little bit of time to speaking to me. So, yeah, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Definitely, definitely go check out House on the Cerulean Sea. Check out really any book that T.J. Klune has written. I know Daniel has read most of those books, but he's read so many other books. We talk about that too, so... You know, I know on my app, you know, with the library, the Libby app, you can search by audiobook narrator as well. And I've done that a few times, just searching for books that Daniel's read. And
even if the book is not my favorite, just hearing, I guess, from Daniel, hearing from an old friend in my ear, just makes it a little bit better. So I really appreciate Daniel's time. Go check out all things Daniel Henning. The links will be in the show note to his website. Go follow along with him on social media. I know that he'll appreciate that. So many amazing things in store for him in this kind of new career. You know, he's been doing it for a while, but he's done so much in entertainment, and then this is kind of a second wind, if you will, and he's just excelling at it so much. So, man, I'm really excited that I was able to speak with him. Maybe eventually we'll talk to TJ Klune as well. And there's not the opportunity for Daniel to read so well without the words being on the page. So it'd be great to speak with him too. But yeah, go, if this is your first time listening to this podcast or you haven't already, go follow along on Instagram and on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast. Go listen on Apple and on Spotify to all 250 other episodes. That'd be great. But even if just listen to a few that interest you the most, leave that 5-star review. That helps a ton. Leave a written review on Apple. Helps even more. But until next week, take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think. Or, hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.